This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today's jobs report, Romney calls it a kick in the gut, Obama calls it a step in the right direction. Could it be both? Growing tired of the same old economic indicators, how about the sandwich indicator? And how a horrendous heat wave in 1995 may be saving lives today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ristall. He's wrapping up his week in Montana, where he's been working on a Marketplace production with Frontline. This is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, July 6th. We're happy to have you here. Do we really have to lead with bad news today? Well, at the very least, it's disappointing news. We're talking about today's big jobs report. The government says the American economy created 80,000 jobs last month, and the jobless rate is treading water at 8.2%. Not exactly fireworks for this 4th of July week. So let's go to the weekly wrap, our look at Wall Street and beyond. We've got Cardiff Garcia at FT Alphaville and Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Sarah.
Lee, the president calls today's report step in the right direction. Romney calls it kick in the gut. Which one is it?
Well, it depends what side you're on. I mean, you know, it's certainly not great, but it's not surprising. And, you know, this is all not great. I mean, the past three months have been not great. This is just more of the same. So, you know, you can parse it and look at the positives within the number, which was that if we can call them positives, I mean, hours worked were up, wage earnings were up. More people entered the job market, which actually can end up sending the unemployment rate up, which we didn't see. So, you know, it again wasn't so unexpected, even if it wasn't great.
Yeah. But should we care if the analysts actually thought it was going to be better than this? Should we pay attention to that and then say this is disappointing, Cardiff?
Honestly, no. I thought it was a bad report.
Yeah.
Job growth was pretty stagnant across most sectors. As Lee mentioned, it is the third consecutive pretty bad report. But I'd really emphasize that it's dangerous to just look at one monthly report because if you look at sort of the underlying pace of jobs growth for the last 6 months, it's a little better. And I think the real message we should take is that things just weren't as good as we thought they were earlier in the year, but neither are they deteriorating quite as badly as I think some will interpret this report to say.
Right.
So I really just think that we probably should remain calm about this because we're not really going to know exactly what's been happening for the last few months for some time. But for the most part, I'm not encouraged, and I do think that this is going to lead to quite a bit of commentary on both sides, as Lee said, and also it's going to really raise the possibility of, well, what do we do about it?
Yeah, Lee, you mentioned there was more hiring of temp workers, right? Is that's good news, isn't it,
or
is that bad news?
No, that's good news. That's good news. That's normally seen as a pre-indicator of things getting better. But, you know, with these numbers, we've even seen this pattern before. So it's like we can no longer really take what looks like what we thought it used to be and make assumptions on that because things change so much, as Cardiff said. So and the other thing is it's really, you know, corporate profits are at record highs right now. So this is not about companies not having the wherewithal to be able to hire. It's all about confidence. And that's all it's ever been for the past at least 18 months, if not longer.
Yeah. Cardiff, hourly wages were up. Why do you think that is?
Well, let's remember that they're coming up off a pretty low base.
Right.
The same thing applies to that sort of weekly number that Lee just talked about. And so I think, especially with these sort of smaller sub-index kind of measures, that we really just shouldn't overinterpret them. Again, let's look at the long term, and let's really look at exactly what Lee's talking about, what's been happening since the recovery started, which is that it's just been sluggish, slow. It's been getting a little bit better, but ever so slowly, and just not anywhere close to adequate given the scale of the unemployment problem. So you can look at those things and call them silver linings if you want, but I look at them and I think, well, just not that meaningful right now. Things just aren't getting better fast enough, but neither are they about to collapse the way I think a lot of people fear.
Yeah. So what's to be done? I mean, are there going to be a lot of calls for the Fed to do something to light a fire here, Lee?
Well, you know, we're certainly hearing that. The Fed has extended its Operation Twist, which is a mechanism to hold down long-term interest rates through the end of the year. There's talk about, will it do another QE3, a wholesale, you know, intervention? There's not a whole lot the Fed can do. It might act, but our problem is not one of liquidity. It's not one of, I mean, the Fed has very limited ability to get companies to hire, yeah, and to stimulate that way. We really need policy moves, and that's not going to happen because of the election and the Congress, which is unlikely to do anything for a number of reasons.
Yeah. 15 seconds. Cardiff, do you think today's report should make the president even more nervous for November?
A little more nervous, not that much more nervous. I think what happens in the 3 months leading up to the elections are going to matter a lot more than the past 3 months.
Yeah.
But certainly it didn't help. So obviously both sides are going to try to capitalize on this. But I really don't think it's going to be one of the sort of big issues. I think we need to wait a few more months.
Okay. Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville, Lee Gallagher of Fortune. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, Sarah. You too.
Thanks, Sarah. Take care.
Not a pretty scene on the stock market today. Details when we do the numbers. Speaking of jobs and work, on Monday we bite into the power lunch. Does it still exist? Some of you say not so much.
In my photo, you can see me holding up my protein bar. 3 or 4 days out of the week, I will eat protein bars at my desk versus eat lunch out or have a more larger, you know, more robust lunch.
Now, that was Sean from Wichita, Kansas, talking about his power bar. That's his lunch. We want to hear what your lunch is like these days. Always at your desk, out with friends, healthy, deep fried maybe. Tweet us at Marketplace APM like Sean did, or submit a photo on our Facebook page. We talk a lot on Marketplace about the credit crunch and how hard it can be for middle-class borrowers to get a loan right now. Well, for the poor, the credit gap is even wider and harder to cross. Sometimes they end up going to payday lenders who charge exorbitant interest rates. But now there is an alternative lender on the scene that caters to Hispanics. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler found it in San Jose, California.
We're close to Silicon Valley, where entrepreneurs play with millions of dollars in venture capital. But around here, a loan of even $1,000 is hard to come by. Many Hispanics have not traditionally felt welcome at banks, so they haven't established the credit history needed to get a loan. A company called Progreso Financiero fills that gap. At this nondescript one-room office in a shopping center, a soft-spoken man asks about a loan. The loan officer tells him to come back with a valid ID, a utility bill, and recent pay stubs. Progreso Financiero has developed its own system to analyze the risk of borrowers who don't have a formal credit history. People like Jose Arellano.
I went to one bank and tried to get credit, but they didn't accept me for a loan. So I came to Progreso Financiero, and they accepted me.
Arellano paid off his $900 loan. Then he borrowed again. Both times he invested the money in his business, cleaning houses. Before he took out his first loan, he says,
we had only 100 customers. And after I get the loan here, I just make my advertising. That helped me to increase my business 400%.
The loans also helped Arellano build his credit rating. He says he may shop around for a better deal on his next loan. That doesn't bother the CEO of Progreso Financiero, Raul Vazquez.
A good outcome for us can be that a customer builds a credit score with us and then over time goes and works with a different financial institution and then gets access to products at lower cost to them.
This isn't a charity. The company is in business to make money. The company operates about 75 branches in California and Texas. This kiosk inside a San Jose grocery store is one of the original locations. Customers drop by to make loan payments in cash. I spoke to folks who borrowed money for medical bills, college expenses, even a woman who's building a house back in Mexico, $2,500 at a time. Javier Guijosa did have one complaint.
Me gusta, está un poco carito los intereses, pero me gusta.
He says he likes the company, but thinks the interest rates are expensive. A $500 loan paid over 7 months carries an annual interest rate of 46%. For a larger loan spread over a year and a half, the interest rate falls to 36%. Lauren Saunders is managing attorney with the National Consumer Law Center.
36% or 46% is a lot, but it's not impossible if it's over a long enough period of time in installments without fees that pile up.
Saunders has studied alternatives to payday lenders, including Progreso Financiero.
This is much better than a payday loan.
For example, Progreso only charges a single fee, and borrowers can't take out a new loan until they've paid off the first loan.
A payday loan is repayable at your next payday. That could be 2 weeks later in a big lump sum, and it just puts you behind the next month, which forces you to borrow again and again and again with a new fee every time at rates that add up to 300 or 400% annual interest or more.
Comparatively, Progreso Financiero sounds like a bargain. The company's not yet profitable, so it also pays high rates for the money it lends out. CEO Raul Vazquez says as the company's costs decrease, he plans to pass along that savings to customers in the form of lower interest rates. In San Jose, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
While we're talking interest rates, the British Parliament has voted to set up an inquiry into the ethics of the British finance industry. That was prompted by the banking scandal involving Barclays. Barclays was fined $450 million and its three top execs quit after regulators found that the bank's staff rigged a key interest rate called LIBOR. Some Brits fear that London could now lose its crown as the world's top financial center to, dear God, not Wall Street. From the British capital, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
You can always tell when the Brits are rattled. This happens in Parliament.
He has impugned my integrity.
The House erupts. Insults fly. Not surprising, really. One of the world's most crucial interest rates, the benchmark for trillions of dollars worth of financial transactions, has been rigged. And it happened here in London. Stuart Fraser speaks for the city's financial centre, and he's certainly rattled.
This is very, very damaging on an international basis, and this is why we need to get this sorted out quickly and to deal with it quickly, because if it's allowed to fester, it will make more permanent damage to our reputation.
And London had been doing so well. The city had leapt ahead of New York as the leading financial centre. Wall Street was hamstrung with regulations like Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank. London was free and easy. But Ed Miliband said that's how we got into this mess. He's the leader of the opposition Labour Party.
There's been a tendency in this country towards deregulation, light-touch regulation. It was wrong. It was wrong. And it's got to change for the future.
Tighter regulation could now be on its way from the European Union. Economist Andrew Hilton says Britain's European partners have been trying to rein in London for years.
There are lots of people in Frankfurt and in Brussels who want to nail the Brits, who believe that the British approach to financial innovation is dangerous and that it should be controlled.
He says the rate-rigging scandal could now prompt over-regulation, which will harm London even further.
I think it is damaging. I think it will hurt the city.
And Wall Street may well edge ahead once again. Ironic, really. At the heart of the rate-rigging scandal lies a highly aggressive trading culture. I wonder where that came from. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up...
The mayor of Chicago was on vacation at his beach home. The health commissioner was on vacation at her beach home. Essentially, the B team was running Chicago during a grade A catastrophe.
What we learned from the 1995 Chicago heat wave. But first, let's do the numbers. Those jobs numbers today, they pummeled the markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled 124 points or 1% to close at 12,772. The NASDAQ fell 1.3%, 38 points to 2937. And the S&P 500 dropped 1% or 12 points to close the week at 1354. For the week, the Dow fell 0.8%. The S&P lost 0.5%. The NASDAQ finished up slightly. Stocks took losses across the board. Morgan Stanley down 2.5%. Bank of America dropped 2%. Foreign markets shared in the misery. Britain's FTSE dropped 0.5%. Frank's CAC 40 fell almost 2%. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. European finance ministers meet in Brussels. The main topic of conversation, a bailout of Spain's banks. But don't hold your breath for a decision that day. Negotiations could take a while. It's earnings season. We'll hear from aluminum manufacturer Alcoa and also from Yum Brands, the folks who run Taco Bell and KFC. And happy 55th birthday to actor Tom Hanks. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. We spend a lot of time on this show talking about economic indicators, unemployment numbers, new home sales, gas prices, anything that will give us a hint of how the economy's doing and where we're headed. Of course, there are the official indicators and the unofficial indicators, things like traffic or stores going out of business. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith checked in with some economists to see what alternative signs they look to gauge how the economy is doing.
Clothes may not make the man, but men's clothes do make a good economic indicator, says economist Max Wolf with Greencrest Capital.
If there's large liquidation sales in the men's suit business, folks don't tend to buy suits and ties unless they more or less have to for work.
Marilyn Cohen is a bond market expert at Envision Capital Management. She spends a lot of time looking at complicated economic indicators like treasury auctions and high yield spreads. Her economic indicator of choice?
Starbucks domestic sales.
Cohen says whether or not people are willing to splurge on a venti frappuccino tells you a lot about their financial situation.
It tells you the fear that people have about the economy and about their job security.
My favorite one is what I call the sandwich indicator.
Justin Wolfers is an economist at Princeton University. He pays attention to who is working entry-level jobs, say, when he orders a sandwich at the local deli.
During the depth of a recession, often it'll be served by someone who serves not only a wonderful sandwich, but also a side of German philosophy as well.
Turkey with a side of Schopenhauer? They're probably overqualified. Economist Gary Schilling has his own special way to tap into the economic buzz.
I'm a beekeeper, and I found an interesting correlation between how well the bees are doing and how well the stock market does.
Schilling says if his bees produce a lot of honey, the stock market tends to do well that year. If they don't, markets tend to fall. His bees have been right the last 5 out of 6 years. You know what I'm going to ask you next, which is what was your honey haul this year?
Not good. Not good.
Those economic indicators can sting. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
One economic indicator we're pretty obsessed with these days is gas prices. And if you drive a car, you're probably thrilled when gas and oil prices fall. But the ebbing price of petroleum is causing anxiety in some parts of the country. Take South Texas, where several small towns enjoying the oil boom stand to gain from expensive crude. Andrew Oxford reports.
The outskirts of Pearsall, Texas are scraggly, dry, and flat. Blake Olson and John Pettit admit it's an unlikely place to open a new restaurant.
A year ago, I don't think anybody would say, hey, let's go to South Texas and open a business.
That's Olson. With about 10,000 people, Pearsall is a small town. Olson used to work in Austin, which is about 2 hours to the north of here. Now he's capitalizing on an oil and natural gas boom that has brought more than 50,000 workers to South Texas in just 3 years. The Pearsall General Store opened about 2 months ago. Pettit says they've been busy.
Semi-permanent population has just exploded. There's not the capacity locally in any of these small communities to service the people that are coming in, whether it's food or drink or gasoline.
Energy companies like Chesapeake and Anadarko come to drill on what's known as the Eagleford Shale. The oil and gas formation stretches from the Mexican border up past San Antonio. Companies have been able to start drilling quickly because of the technique known as fracking. In 2008, only 13 drilling permits were issued in the region. In 2011, more than 3,800 permits were granted. Thomas Tunstall has been studying the Eagleford Shale. He's an economist at the University of Texas at San Antonio.
The best line I've heard about the activity in the Eagleford area is to look at it as kind of a bonus and to bank it and engage in medium and long-term planning and use the money to have a suitable infrastructure in place that will attract either new visitors, new residents, or new businesses.
Across South Texas, some ranching families are being offered more than $1 million for mineral rights. Several people told me there was a job for anybody who could pass a drug test. Even fast food restaurants are paying $15 an hour. But what happens when the energy companies leave? How long can the Eagleford Shale last? I put that question to John Pettit back at the Pearsall General Store.
What's the long term? Pessimists are saying 3 years. The eternal optimists are saying 30 years. I think it's probably somewhere in between there.
You don't want to let short-term greed lead you to long-term problems.
That's Mike Wilson. He's the president of Security State Bank in Pearsall. It's been in business for a while.
From 1925.
The bank was around for the last energy boom, and the one before that. Even though deposits are up 82% since 2009, Wilson is cautious about loaning to businesses that are relying on the energy companies sticking around.
If the price of oil drops and you've invested in a bunch of motels that now don't get enough people to pay the light bill, much less make your payment, it'd be great for 3 years, but it might hang you in years 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Or the residents here could wait for the next energy boom. They're already talking about an even bigger gas deposit that's located under the Eagleford Shale. In Pearsall, Texas, I'm Andrew Oxford for Marketplace.
Here in Los Angeles, it's a mild 73 degrees today. We've been spared the extreme heat much of the country's been battling the past few weeks. Weather forecasters are warning people in the Midwest and East to prepare for a scorcher this weekend. There have been heat-related deaths this year, but nothing like, say, what Chicago experienced back in 1995 when hundreds of people died in a disastrous heat wave. Eric Kleinenberg wrote a book about that called Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. Eric Kleinenberg, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here.
What is the difference between 1995 and the heat wave we've got going on in the country now?
Well, first of all, hard as it is to believe, it's actually cool this week compared to Chicago in 1995.
Yeah.
That week, the temperature hit 106.
Wow.
And the heat index, which measures experienced heat, went to 126. And the other big thing is that there were no evening cooling to provide natural relief.
Right. So that 99 degrees that they experienced in Chicago today, that's nothing.
They dreamed about 99 in 1995.
Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, what happened is that 739 people in excess of the norm died, and thousands more were hospitalized. As it turns out, the mayor of Chicago was on vacation at his beach home, The health commissioner was on vacation at her beach home.
No.
The fire commissioner who ran the paramedics group was in Florida. Essentially, the B team was running Chicago during a grade A catastrophe.
I read today there have been some heat-related deaths in Chicago, but it's nothing like this. What has changed, if anything?
First of all, the city in 1995 didn't do half the things it could have done to prevent deaths. Today, we're far more aware of the dangers of extreme heat than we were in 1995. We're sensitized because of climate change, but also we've learned some things from Chicago and from the European heat wave in 2003, which killed about 35,000 people, according to some estimates. So people are aware about what they need to do, and governments do far more.
What are governments doing better?
Many cities now have identified the most old and frail, isolated people, and they reach out to them when the heat strikes. Governments are also working with local media to make sure that they treat heat waves as serious public health issues. No more meteorologists frying eggs on the sidewalk. When you know that there's a catastrophe that could really kill people, you treat it differently, and now people are getting the word out.
What haven't we done that we should do?
We have yet to prepare ourselves for a world in which this kind of weather is the new normal. Bear in mind, the heat wave in Chicago in 1995 lasted 3 days. The one in Europe that killed 35,000 people in 2003 lasted for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Right now, our power grids aren't up to snuff. We consume so much energy that many cities see the power go out for long periods of time. That happened in 1995, and it's happening in many cities across the country this week.
You mentioned earlier we're more aware of climate change now, but I noticed that a lot of reporters, they refrain from making a connection between these individual heat events or weather-related events and climate change. Are they just being cautious? Are they being accurate? Or are they doing the public a disservice?
It's impossible to say that any one given heat event is due to climate change, but what the most sophisticated climate studies are showing is that we're seeing far more cases like this, and we're going to have to find a way to change things because it's just too much for us to bear.
Eric Kleinenberg is a sociologist at NYU. Professor, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, the latest fast food trend that's going to drive parents crazy. Soda for breakfast. Three chains, Steak and Shake and some Taco Bells and Sonics, are promoting breakfast deals that include drinks like a 28-ounce Coke starting at 6 in the morning. Some Taco Bells in California are testing out Mountain Dew with orange juice. One place they probably won't be test marketing the soda for breakfast thing, New York City. That's where Mayor Michael Bloomberg is trying to ban supersized sodas any time of the day. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 124 points, or 1%. The NASDAQ dipped 38 points, 1.3%. And the S&P 500 ditched 12 points, that's 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on Marketplace Money, ever wondered what it's like to sightsee when you're blind?
I use my other senses. Well, I had the experience that when we were in England, I got a chance to touch the gates at Buckingham Palace. Just different ways to sightsee. I call it sight feeling.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.